It is Saturday, March 31st, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our Week in Geek news segment, and of course in the second half, your calls and questions of technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. So please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we're doing the geek news, the news of the week, and during the second half, I'll welcome you to join the conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can contact us now. Just send us an email to geeks@geekspeak.org. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxel. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, a Slacker geek and student, and Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, gentlemen, we're going to take people's calls during the second half of the show. But the first half of the show, we're going to do news of the week and what's been going on in technology. And I'd like to start with you, Mr. Cleveland. Sean, morning.
Good morning. News.
I caught you off guard. I'm sorry.
I'm not off guard.
Oh, good.
Let's talk about Intel's next generation of CPUs. Everybody's really excited about their current Core 2 Duo and Core 2 Extreme and their quad-core chips. Pretty exciting stuff. And
now
AMD's got new stuff coming out. But what I mean by that is dual-core means two processor cores on the same chip, physical chip, and quad-core means four cores. So you essentially have four processors.
And they've done this has been happening for a while. AMD has some solutions like this, similar. And the idea is that they've got why put multiple cores on the chip? I know we take this kind of stuff for granted
because you can. Just imagine if you could shrink your house
and build a second one,
and then you've got all this extra space on your property, and you could build another one. Why not?
Okay,
that's what's happening on the die, right?
I mean, you wouldn't really want to do that,
but. You know, what's happening is as you shrink the architecture down, you are making more space on the die. And you would think that devices would get smaller and smaller, but they are. But desktop machines aren't. You're always going to see desktop systems and tower cases, you know.
Right.
What they're figuring out is how to add more performance and hopefully do that in a way that uses less power.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all working towards this. But let's take a peek into the future.
Yeah.
I got this data from Daily Tech. I don't know if you go to dailytech.com. It's an interesting site. It's a good place to get some quick news. And what's great about them is they have comments. So
everybody
they put up a story and everybody comments right away. So I like that aspect of the site. And GeekSpeak will be moving that way too
at some point
in the future.
Definitely.
So the second half of this year, Intel will release its first 45-nanometer-based processor. It's codenamed Pinrin. The code names are just names to refer to a product before it actually launches. We really don't know what it's going to be called. But when they announce the name, then Pinrin will supposedly go away, you know. So Pinrin is, it's a die shrink. So they're making even more space for more cache. Up to 12, or is that right? 12 megs.
Wow.
Of cache.
Whoa. Now the cache
on the CPU itself?
Yeah.
So
12 megs of L2 cache on the CPU.
Right then.
That's nice.
So they're not really revolutionizing. They're just kind of just throwing a lot more memory onto the chip that can be used by applications for. So it may not be the most efficient way to do things. So the memory controller, they don't have an onboard memory controller. In fact, that's what they announced and their next generation after Penryn. What I want to talk about next. But so in what they're doing is they're taking their current generation of technology, which is actually based off Pentium 3. I don't know if you realize this, but all they went back to Pentium 3 and they did a bunch of Core 2 stuff. Mm-hmm. Is that architecture with a lot of updates and fixes and modernizations. So they've taken that again and they're just putting more cache in there.
Now the cache is the really, really fast memory that's like right next to the processor.
Right.
It's the memory that's kind of, it's equivalent to our memory, not using paper to write something down, but which would be normal RAM and actually accessing something on your desk. It's actually in... It's really close.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain in a metaphorical way, but Miles, you're going to try it? You're normally good with metaphors. Can you give us a metaphor for L2 cache?
Level 2 cache would be like your short-term memory.
Okay.
It's something that's just around the tip of your tongue. It's something you're working with at the time. Say you're at your desk and you're working on some stuff. It's the papers that are on the top sitting on your desk, but once you have to go shuffling through...
Actually, then the L2 cache would be your memory. Yeah,
yeah,
and when you have to go to your desk to look through papers,
that's
accessing the hard drive.
That's
when you have to open up the file cabinet.
Yeah, the file cabinet is the hard drive. Yeah, okay, that metaphor got stretched enough. So they're making L2 cache. And let's give an example of what normal people have the normal chips that people have if they bought a computer last year. How much L2 cache do they have right now?
1 meg if they're lucky, probably 512K.
Okay,
the Core 2 Duos now have two megs of cache and 4 megs of cache, depending on how much money you want to spend. The quad core has, I believe, 8 megs of cache.
Nice.
It's 4x2. And, yeah, these will have up to 12.
Now, is this a big difference, Intel going to an off-the-chip memory controller? Is that something really new?
I haven't gotten there yet. So, 45 on Penryn, 45 nanometer is quite a shrink. It won't be silicon-based anymore. They're moving to metal transistor gates and high-K dielectrics. What that means is... they're going to get a 5-fold reduction in drain leakage, basically.
Whoa.
From around the transistors. Right now, when you shrink it data down that low, electricity can actually leak onto,
and that's a lot
transistors
of wasted
next to
heat.
It. Yeah, it does. It is a lot of wasted heat. It can cause issues. By doing this, they're saying that a mature Penryn processor could run possibly 20% faster.
Wow.
And operate up to possibly 3 gigahertz per core.
Okay, if they're not doing silicon anymore, the actual media is a different type of material. Isn't that a giant new refab? I mean, isn't that a big retool for the fabs?
The fabs
are going that way?
Pretty much there already.
Oh, okay.
Right. And also I wanted to...
They're building these chips now. They're just not released yet.
Okay.
I want to bring up when we talk about 45 nanometer, just to make sure that people know what scale we're talking about here. A nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of a millimeter.
Oh my gosh, that's small.
So that means that wires on a CPU.
So if you take a ruler that you normally, like a desk ruler, and you look at the numbers you don't normally see, you don't normally use, that's centimeters. And then in between the little 10 dashes in between the centimeter numbers, those are millimeters.
Mm-hmm.
So a million separations between those little tiny, basically the smallest separation on your ruler, split that a million times, that's the size we're talking about.
Or rather, take 40, split it a million times and take 45 of them.
Yeah, that's too confusing. That 40. Yeah. So what's the size right now of the traces being laid down on like the Core 2 Duo? How big is that?
The new ones are 65 nanometer.
So it's 45 is quite a bit
smaller.
Well,
that's where chips, yeah. Yeah, 45 is quite a bit smaller.
And they had to move away from silicon. Are we going to stop calling it silicon? I mean, we still call chips silicon. You know, we talk about that industry, the silicon industry, Silicon Valley, all that. And we're moving away from silicon. That's kind of interesting, don't you think?
I don't think we'll completely move away from silicon.
We won't. Okay.
The circuit board will still be made of silicon.
Okay.
It's just we're talking at these extreme reductions.
Okay, now are you ready to talk about the memory control?
Yeah, let's talk about the next generation after that. It's called Nehalem, Nehalem. The Nehalem processor architecture is scheduled for production next year. It'll still be a 4-issue architecture, just like the core. Let's not get into that.
Okay.
It'd be kind of cool to get an engineer on and talk about just how these things work. But there's a lot to talk about here. Those will have 8 cores. They will have two-way threading, which means the processors on there will appear as 16 logical CPUs.
Oh, interesting. So
it's
kind of
like,
it's kind of like
hyper-threading right now.
Right.
But this is a much more advanced
hyper-threading was a single core, but pretending to be multiple.
Right.
This is multiple cores.
Yeah. Sophisticated, much more sophisticated, and it's really an interesting way of doing things. Two-way threading. Wow. Yeah.
This is like having 16 brains.
Yeah.
as opposed to just having one brain that
does. This threading is dynamic. So that what that means is that they can be turned on and off depending on application needs.
Nice.
So right now with the dual core, quad core, they're running all the time. Unless you specifically disable it in the BIOS, a core,
right.
Or whatever cores. You always have to have one core running. But at some point in the future, well, with Nehalem, that will happen automatically.
Now, why would you want to disable a core?
Because if you're not using it, you're wasting power.
Nice. So you're actually able to make the processor be a really low power processor, yeah, when it's just idling or playing.
Almost everything songs will be dynamically managed, right, with that Nehalem.
That was the idea with Intel's multiple cores, though, right? Was the fact that trying to shut down parts of a single CPU were really hard, but if you have multiple cores, that because they're all just identical, if they're not being used, turning them off is
That's where they want to get to, but yes, none of them can do that now.
Yeah. But, I mean, that was the idea behind going to all so many cores.
So almost everything can be dynamically managed: power, threads, the bus, cache, and the cores.
Does this mean you can overclock
your
thing in Windows and such?
Huge power-saving features.
Yeah.
You can do that now. Okay. I overclock in Windows all the time with NVIDIA software.
but
that's my job. I'm sorry.
I want to get back. You mentioned a little while ago the idea that they're going to be moving off to off processor memory controller, and I'm wondering how all these cores are going
to
use.
I said they're going to be moving to an on processor memory controller.
On processor. Okay,
but I will get there.
All right.
So let's get there now.
Why not? Go for it.
So AMD has had an onboard memory controller for 4 to 5 years now. The Opteron Bay, the processor, the K8 architecture, and they're on K9 now. They've all had onboard memory controllers since 2000, 2001. Mm-hmm. So that's nothing new. But it's new for Intel.
Yeah.
They've never had one. They've always had a secondary chip that the memory is connected to that controls the flow of data to the processor and back to memory. And they've always had a front side bus that was, not as fast as AMD's. And they're moving up to, and it's a parallel based architecture. Mm-hmm. They're now moving to a serial based front side bus architecture, and what that is that's the front side bus is what connects the processor to all the other chips. So it's not really front side bus anymore, because the memory controller will be on the processor. The front side bus is between the processor and the memory controller, but since it's on the processor, that's really not a front side bus. so we really can't talk about it that way, but from the processor, they'll have a new advanced serial architecture to connect to all the rest of the chips on the board,
including the RAM
in the system, right? Mm-hmm. And AMD has already had this with HyperTransport for a long time.
So why is Intel taking so long doing it?
It's because it's really difficult to innovate.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work involved. And you would think that Intel would be ahead of the game here.
Well,
but when they took Core 2, like I said, they went back to the Pentium 3 architecture and brought it up to speed, and it became a very powerful engine.
The Core 2 is the most powerful processors right now. Intel is just doing great compared to AMD with its speed, and it's amazing that they're not...
To tell you the truth, AMD memory controller is much more efficient and faster than Intel's, but Intel's got so much cash on their chip...
It doesn't matter as much.
That it doesn't matter as much.
All right, I think we got to move on. We've been talking about this for...
Oh, there's more.
I'm afraid we're losing people that aren't as...
This is pretty techie.
It is pretty techie. So let's go on to the next news story. Mr. Elam.
Samsung has... excuse me. Has announced a 64-gigabyte solid-state drive to be released next quarter. This is different from your standard...
How big is the drive? Sorry?
64 gigabytes.
Wow.
So this is different from your standard hard drive in that this is solid state. There are no moving parts. There's no spinning platter in there. And as such, it also doesn't have to physically move ahead to the right place on the platter. So you end up with much faster seek times.
And it's not going to be damaged by shock.
Right. The other things in your computer will be damaged by dropping it on the floor, but your data should be safe. And they're rating the device to be... to have a read time of 64 megabytes per second, or read volume.
Is that pretty fast?
That's a good hard drive. Yeah, 64 megabytes per second. And at 45 megabytes per second.
That's great.
And it will use only half a watt when operating.
Whoa.
0.1 watts when idle.
So this would be wonderful for laptops.
Yes. It was saying, and this is for the laptop market. And they will be expensive.
Yeah.
For a smaller amount of space. That's the trade-off.
But, I mean, we're talking... I mean, one of the largest consumptions of power in your laptop, there's two things, basically the monitor and the hard drive. So putting the hard drive to be a lot less power means a lot less, a lot more playtime.
Right. And actually, let me back up. When I said 64 megabytes per second reading, that is a good desktop or server hard drive.
Right.
Whereas, a lot faster than a laptop hard drive, a 1.8 inch laptop hard drive, one of the really small ones, an 80 gigabyte one reads at about 15 megs
Whoa,
per second.
Whoa, a lot faster.
And writes at 7 megs per second and consumes 1.5 watts, whether it's either operating or idle. It doesn't matter because it's still spinning.
So we're talking about a 6-fold increase in speed off a normal laptop hard drive, which can affect the performance quite a bit, 15 to 60.
Four to five-fold
okay.
increase.
And a decrease in power of 100 times. I mean, it's impressive. So are you gonna go out and get one of those for your MacBook right there?
No, I'm a student. I'm poor. If someone wants to donate one for me to review, that would be perfectly all right.
That means you'd have to write something. So,
hey.
All right, that's a pretty exciting thing. Shall we go on?
Yeah.
All right, next story.
U.S. astronaut Sunita Williams will be running the Boston Marathon from space.
So she That's such cheating. What do you mean? She can't run. So she's going to look out her window and point on the ground. I'm right there. How is she doing that?
Actually, she'll be strapped down to a treadmill, and she'll be running all 26.2 miles on the treadmill as she circles the Earth twice.
So she'll be going a lot faster than anybody else.
A lot faster.
She's going backwards or forwards. Okay, so this isn't fair. I mean, the only reason I'm not running the Boston Marathon is I'm not in Boston. And I can't run more than a mile.
Yeah, what's up with that, huh?
So I think
you should see if you can officially enter.
I know. I wonder if the reason, like, there's a very specific rule that allows an astronaut to do it. You know, you cannot be, you have to be at the location or not on the planet. You know, that's kind of the rule set. Well, that's cool. Is there going to be a camera on her the whole time so you can watch her run it?
That's a good question. I don't know.
And the next question is she going to have a video screen in front of her that's actually somebody's head cam? You know, so that she can see everybody else running. Because half the thing is being with everybody else. One of the biggest marathons in the world. All right, that's pretty cool.
They showed a picture of her on the treadmill at newscientistspace.com. Space.newscientist.com. But, you know, I don't know if it'd be worth watching her all 26.2 miles on the treadmill. Could be kind of a little boring. But she's doing it to encourage kids to start making physical fitness part of their daily lives.
Nice.
That's the whole theme of this. That's kind of cool.
And we say strapped down, of course, because she's
zero-G.
Zero-G, yeah. And she has to be tied down to be able to run.
She's literally strapped down. She has it over her shoulders, and she's strapped down with two big straps on the treadmill.
Yeah. All right, well, good luck to her. Miles?
We talked about the one laptop per child project many times before.
Mm-hmm.
A new development in there is that the company that is manufacturing the laptops for that project, the project to give a laptop to poor children in developing countries to level the playing field for education purposes, is going to be selling the laptop in developed countries like the U.S. and Europe for $200. Now, the laptop is being slated for between $120 as the initial price for countries, and then $100 and hopefully like down to $80 per laptop. The company is, because they've had so much demand from geeks, not like myself saying, hey, this looks like really cool tech. I'd like to play with this. So they're looking at selling it for $200 by the end of this year.
Well, this is funny because every time we talk about the program, the one laptop for child program, you're like, I want to buy one. I'll buy one for twice as much money, but I want to buy one. And now it's clear that they're going to do that.
Right. I don't know if it'll be exactly the same. There's been some question with regard to that, but it's going to use a lot of the technology from it. It's going to have many of the same features. And this will be a great, you know, gift for your children, you guys. I mean, this is the idea is that these laptops are made to be rugged. They're made to be used by little children. I guess the difference between the one laptop per child project and this laptop is going to be sold by a company called Quanta is that they're going to be doing things like making the keyboard full size rather than the compact size made for children's hands, like
right.
The one laptop per child project will do.
Well, that's good. So they're going to have multiple sizes of computer in the sense that physical size, which is kind of funny because normally we don't talk about that very much. So the one laptop per child, the keyboard's actually smaller? Or is it just...
Yeah, it's made for children's
really
hands. Yeah, it's made for, you know, like
I've never seen a small keyboard, like on anything. think that's cool.
Yeah, the One Laptop Per Child project is doing things that no one has done before. They're making things specifically with kids in mind. They're not doing it as, oh, we're going to make these general laptops and try to give them to kids, right, like a full desktop computer. What you have at home that you're using to surf the net from your couch is not what's being sent to these kids.
All right. Thank you very much for the update for the One Laptop Per Child program, Miles. And Sean?
The River Thames in London is being turned into one giant Wi-Fi hotspot. All 22 kilometers of the River Thames.
So if you can touch the river, you got Wi-Fi?
Yeah, or if you could just stand on its banks. So from the Millennium Dome out in Greenwich up to Mill Bank in the Houses of Parliament and beyond in the next month or two, they're doing a mesh technology with 100 access points, but it's not free. It costs money.
Really?
So the company is trying to figure out ways to make public hotspots
free.
You know, into some sort of vehicle for making money.
Hmm.
But I'm just trying to figure out how many people actually walk along the River Thames.
Oh, it's pretty nice.
Is it pretty nice?
There's a whole furrow through.
Maybe it's just the books I read, you know, that they make it out to be so nasty.
Well, at one time it was. It was extremely polluted.
I mean, put
the period books aside, right? And maybe go on the web and see what it looks like.
Yeah, definitely.
But if you're in England and you really need access, you know, just walk down to the river and you might have to pay a little money, but I thought that was interesting.
You're listening to Geekspeak on the central coast of California. So if you're in London, central coast of California, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto. Of course, we're streaming online at KOSP.org. So it's very possible we have London listeners. You know, the big gray thing, Miles. But in a little bit. Yeah, that's it. Miles is trying to talk to me while I'm talking. It's so frustrating. In the air with me is Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. We're going to cover another news story before we invite you to participate. I'm Lyle Troxell. And, Miles, it's your news story, sir. Unless you don't have one. That goes to Sean.
Oh, as a matter of fact, I do have one. We've been touting Firefox, the browser, for a long time now as a secure alternative, or just a better alternative, I should say, to Internet Explorer. And currently, it's on Firefox 2.0. They've already released now three alphas for Firefox 3.0, and you see the roadmap, and you can see where it's going with it. And it's really amazing.
Have you been using it?
I've played around with it a little bit. One of the things that's most amazing to me, though, is not something that's immediately visible from using the interface, which is that they're using a common architecture on the back end. This is known as Zool Runner.
Yeah.
And so you have a common toolkit, and then the browser just works on top of that toolkit. And the idea behind it is that other people can create mini applications and have this base
already installed. This has been pretty interesting since alphas of Firefox 1. I recall you showing me that they had this wonderful development kit and applications were being built on top of it, like Thunderbird, Mozilla. But it had always been pretty integrated in. And if you wanted to build, like, you were kind of building plugins to use the
Zool. Well, it's a lot of custom build.
So now there's there's going to be separation in 3 to make its own platform. This is almost equivalent to having, if you install Firefox, then 3, you actually have kind of like a Java runtime environment in the sense that it's a generic thing you can build an application for. If you've got Firefox, you can also run these applications on any operating system.
Right. It's kind of like Java or .NET, having installing the .NET runtime environment, and then you can have your application, this really small stub, go on there. As long as .NET's on there, you can run just fine.
.NET's not exactly a great solution because, of course, you're only on Windows for .NET.
Right.
So this is a cross-platform. You could be on Linux, Windows, or Macintosh.
Right, and unlike the Java Virtual Machine, which is just one specific language, although you can do some scripting languages, this is more language agnostic, but it's also making applications like you would make a web page. You're using JavaScript, you're using CSS, you're using markup, either HTML or their own XML markup language, Zool.
All right, so is it ready? Are we ready to download 3?
No, it's an alpha, so I wouldn't recommend that the general user do it. But if you like tinkering, if you like playing around with application development, or if you're an advanced web developer and you want to see what the future really is going to be like in terms of application development, get a toehold in, I do recommend downloading it and giving it a shot. And
I don't. I'm sorry. I don't.
If you're a geek.
After Firefox 2, I don't recommend downloading it until after the first few patches come out.
Yeah.
After the final is released. It's horrible.
Are you happy with Firefox 2 now?
Yeah, I am now, but it's taken them a long time to get the stability.
Oh, it's sure it crashed, but at the same time, it saved your session data, so it didn't matter.
GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. Maggie Cleveland's waiting in the house. She's to produce GeekSpeak. She's been away for a long time, but she's here today to take your calls and pipe them in the air room. And the phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, the numbers are to call in with any questions you'd like to ask us. We'll definitely answer them. We're not sure what we'll say or if it'll be accurate, but we'll definitely answer them. 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Of course, that's 831 area code. And anywhere in California, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP. Again, 1-800-655-5877. And if you'd like, you can send us an email at geeks@geekspeak.org. Stay tuned with KUSP after GeekSpeak this morning at 11 a.m., Castle Cottage with Susan Freeman. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Trox. The geeks in the air room, ready to take your calls. Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland. Let's go ahead and do one more news story as we're waiting for calls to pipe
in. And we have Chris and Didi on Instant Message, so if we don't know what's going on, we can ask them.
They always back us up and
they sure
tell us what's going on. Oh, actually, no, we got a call right away from Santa Cruz, so let's go ahead and take that. Hal, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question today?
This is Hal in Santa Cruz. I just turned it on when you're talking about the laptop for kids, and somebody made the comment that they'd never seen a keyboard for kids.
That was me.
Yeah. I have the Vio VGN TX, and just yesterday I posted a comment online about it that it's an absolutely fantastic machine, except the keyboard's too small, and that if they had the ThinkPad size keyboard, it would be the greatest. It is a smaller keyboard, and I would think it would be great for kids.
Yeah, but it's not great for you.
Right.
We're talking about one of these micro laptops that run for a long time.
Yeah. This one gets about 8 hours of battery life.
That's pretty good. This is a Vio. Which Vio is it?
It's a VGN-TX750P, and it has a 1.2 gigahertz processor, which is described as ultra-low voltage.
Yeah, lasts a long. That's where you get the 8 hours of speed. But the one thing you say is problematic is the small keyboard, which would be, of course,
great. It weighs 2.7 pounds, and it has an optical drive.
Nice.
So it's very pricey. I actually bought it cheap on eBay, but
not something you buy for a kid, huh?
But no, it's not a $200 machine, and I hate the keyboard, but it would be great for a kid.
So the question is, are you returning this? Are you wanting to sell it, or are you
No, I've had it for a while, and, you know, when I'm traveling, you can't always plug in. It's got
great
wireless access. Other people can't find an access point, and I'm on already.
Well, I stand corrected because I have seen Vios, so I have seen small keyboards. I just didn't think of it as a benefit, like a small child keyboard. So thank you for the call, and good luck on computing use. Of course, you can
buy
an external USB keyboard and plug that in to use that machine a little more.
You know, widescreen notebooks.
Would make it a little less portable.
It would. Thank you so much, Hal, for the call.
Sure, bye.
Widescreen notebooks generally have bigger keyboards.
Right. The real issue there, of course, is that you want to keep it as small as possible, and the keyboard at one point has to shrink. Let's go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz again. Glenn, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. How are you guys?
Quite well. What's your question today, sir?
Well, I've got a desktop system with an AMD 3500. I don't remember the exact CPU number, but 3500 plus something. Anyway, it came with a gigabyte of RAM in two chip holders that were let's see, DDR 400, and I wanted to upgrade to 2 gigabytes.
Uh-huh.
There were two more slots, so I bought another pair, matched pair, and my performance when I was running VMware slowed down by a factor of about 10.
When I added the new RAM,
and doing things like opening up Microsoft Word in Windows and just standard routine things seemed fine. I didn't notice anything.
It's just VMware.
But VMware just ground to a halt.
How much RAM do you now have?
Well, So it was a gigabyte.
Okay, now you have a gigabyte.
Yeah, and initially I started out with one of the higher-end Corsair solutions. And
right.
And I called Corsair. They said, oh, no, you've got AMD. The memory controller is built into the CPU.
Yep.
And the high-end Corsair RAM that you bought needed 2.7 volts, and you need the the value select, so get the 2.5 volt RAM. So I did that.
Oh, this is DDR. Sure, DDR. That makes sense.
Same problem.
Yeah.
So finally,
you know what's happened is you've really increased the electrical load on your motherboard by putting four sticks of memory in there.
Huh.
So. So
why would it only
so what happens is
why they give you the slots if that's
yeah I know it won't run as fast, but I don't see why it really shouldn't make that much of a difference, especially with VMware.
Yeah.
Are you pretty good at VMware? Are you tuning it and such? I mean,
no.
I'm wondering if there's settings in VMware to use how much RAM and using it percentage, and therefore it's taking.
You know what I would do
is
take out your original two sticks of memory.
Yeah.
And then run it with the two new ones.
Oh, I did that. And
how was the performance?
That was fine. It was about equivalent.
And then so when you added the two back in...
Either pair alone worked fine. And so I was allocating about 600 megabytes to the VM session, was running Red Hat Linux Enterprise Edition. And with 1 gigabyte of RAM and 600 megabytes allocated to the VM session, it was fine. But when I put in 2 gigabytes of RAM and left it at 600,
You know what I would do? First thing I would do is write down the make and model number of your motherboard.
Yep.
Pop the side off. Go to the website, Asus.com, MSI, wherever. You can look it up on a Google search and get the latest BIOS for your motherboard.
That's a very good idea.
Because those BIOS updates always contain new memory data.
I'd go with that.
Yeah. And there very well could be a fix for this and a new BIOS update.
Another thing you might want to do, since you just doubled your RAM, is take the you shut down the machine, take the old RAM out and put this new RAM in the location and see how it performs. And also, when you're dealing with RAM slots, your four slots, matched and unmatched is not necessarily necessary. And I'm wondering, Sean, is it possible that he's actually mixing his matching because it's actually a toggled match? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so...
How do you determine?
It really depends on how many layers the motherboard is and how it's designed, whether slots 1 and 2 go together and 3 and 4 go together, or 1 and 3 go together
you
and 2 and 4 go together.
You definitely want to download the PDF of the board information
but
as well.
Yeah. Okay. Matched memory, just because it's the same make memory, it's not matched.
Well, he bought matched.
Yeah. When you buy matched memory, it means that the two pieces were built right next to each other and they're tested to run at a specific, a really high-end speed together. And then when you've put in other memory next to it, not only have you increased the load on the board and the memory speeds can't run as fast, but the fact that you're not running just two pieces of matched memory, you're running four pieces, it can mess with the memory speeds. You will certainly not run it as fast as you would with two sticks.
Huh.
So if you're buying a new machine and you want to put in 2 gigs of memory, I would recommend getting 2 1-gig modules instead of 4 or 5 12 megs.
Good point.
Yeah. Cost more, but bite the bullet and do it.
If you're interested in performance, then that's the way to go.
Glenn, thank you so much for the call.
One question. I've heard that that Intel doesn't have this kind of problem because they have off-chip external memory controllers.
Well, they do, but AMD's memory controller is much more efficient.
Hmm.
But then again, Intel's using DDR2 memory, and you've got to be using the latest AMD processors to take advantage of DDR2 memory.
Mm. Okay.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Well, I could talk about memory for a long time. We could do a whole show just on memory.
Let's go ahead and take a call from Pacific Grove. Gene, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question today?
I don't know if it's a stupid question. It's a simple question. I'm not a geek.
There's no stupid questions, only stupid people.
Okay, anyway... on my system, I have Windows ME, and I'm wondering, is it because of that, or is it because of I have dial-up, I don't have a DSL connection, that if I go to YouTube, it's slow motion. In other words, I can't watch YouTube. I have to go to the library and use one of their computers. Is it my dial-up connection, or is it because I'm in an old operating?
Yes, it's your dial-up connection.
Okay,
just
cool.
The video bandwidth just can't come through that small a pipe.
Yeah.
seamlessly. You'd have to sit there and wait for the YouTube video to
catch up. Does go like I said, more than slow motion. On the other hand, when I do an audio, that seems to come through all right.
Yeah, when you are on YouTube and it starts loading the bar, can you just pause it and wait till it fully loads and then play it?
No.
Okay, so it just starts playing and it's just frame by frame?
Yeah.
I would recommend that you get the most latest version of Flash Player. And you should be able to get, I think the Flash is still going to be compatible with 98 or Millennium.
Why would this make a difference?
Yeah. Because the Flash Player is actually the thing that plays videos on YouTube, and it should cache, it should wait to play the video until it started loading, until it's got enough to load. It's built into the Flash Player. If you have a different version of the Flash plugin, then that code might not be functioning, and that's why he's seeing it starting to play right away.
Where do you get Flash?
Adobe.com. You can download the Flash Player. It used to be Macromedia, but now
doesn't that also assume that the Flash movie or YouTube's movies are actually written that way? The players?
I think it's written that way. I've never seen a situation where it starts playing until it's ready to play all the way through.
I have it happen.
Yeah?
Occasionally, yeah. So, I don't know.
Do I do that and pay for that through Adobe?
No, something? No, it's free. It's a free download.
Oh, okay, well, I'll get that right first.
Now, the one thing, let's be clear, when you're on YouTube and you see the video and it starts to go slow motion, there should be a play pause button. If you push that button, does it stop?
I haven't done that.
Okay, try pushing that pause button and seeing there should be like a bar that's kind of not filled in color, and it will slowly fill in. I believe it's red.
Right.
And when it's red all the way, it means you've cached the entire movie and you've got a copy of it locally, and then you should be able to play it at full speed.
Okay, if it doesn't work, try to.
Okay, good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Miles, you look confused and concerned.
Well, I was also wondering where this person lived, just because really
he's from Pacific Grove.
Yeah, whether DSL is available.
Ah, yes. Gene upgraded DSL. Well, I think he seemed pretty excited that when we said it was a speed connection, it sounded like he might be getting DSL soon. So the question is, can a Millennium Sheen play YouTube videos? And yeah, they can.
Yes, they can.
Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and go to Felton. Sylvia, welcome to GeekSpeak. Sylvia, are you with us?
Hi. Yes.
Hi.
Good morning.
What's your question
today? I have a question regarding hot sinking a tungsten T3 with, I have a Mac G4 on OS 10.4.9.
Wait, I'm sorry. 10.4.9?
Uh-huh.
Okay, most recent version of OS 10.
Okay, so I have the Palm desktop software, mm-hmm. 4.2.1, installed, and I've tried several things. What happens is now I am able to, when I attempt the hot sync, it does, the cradle connects, there is a connection with the computer, but then after the hot sync starts, I get an error message. Well, it stops, and then mm-hmm. the error message says, the application conduit manager quit unexpectedly. And I've tried a variety of different things, from uninstalling all the Palm software I could find on the computer and using the original CD that came with the tungsten, and then putting the downloaded desktop.
Okay, well, one thing I'm going to suggest, because Chris is actually chatting with us a little bit. I think we might have lost him, but Chris, if you're listening, please get on and help us out. He recommended a company called Markspace.com. Dee Dee's filling in. This is me reading a chat log in front of me, trying to figure out what they're suggesting.
It's called Missing Sync.
Missing Sync, and it's on Markspace.com. Markspace.com. And that hooks into iSync, which is Apple's iSync solution. So iSync should manage the conduit for you, I believe. So definitely go to markspace.com and see if there's a thing called Missing Sync.
Yeah, actually looks pretty good. Might help, yeah.
Missing.
Just go to markspace.com.
Markspace.com, and that should help you out. Good.
Okay, it's really odd because I have the same setup at my office. It's a G4, but it's a desktop, not a laptop, and I have no problem.
Are you running OS 10 on that machine?
Yeah.
Okay, then you want to. I think you should erase your preferences and let it, and basically reinstall, if you will, because it's very possible that you've got a connection problem with that. The other thing is, is this a USB connected Palm device? You connect to USB. Do you have anything else on your USB connection? Do you have like a printer or something?
I have a printer, and then I have the USB for a wireless mouse.
Okay, so this is what I suggest doing. Unplug all the USB peripherals on your laptop and just plug in the Palm device and try syncing. It's very possible you're getting conflict in the USB bus or a speed issue. I mean, it's just a guess.
I don't know.
Does it matter which port I plug the Palm into?
On your keyboard, on your laptop, no, it shouldn't.
Okay.
The other thing is, do you have tech support at work?
No.
It's so nice when you can call in a geek. So missing sync replaces the need for iSync with the Palm. It allows you to do it without iSync. So that might be a good solution. So again, the URL, Sean, was
markspace.com.
Thank you so much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. If you'd like to call into Geek Speak, you're welcome to do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. The Geeks of the Day are Sean Cleveland and Miles Elam. We also have Dee Dee and Chris on AIM, and so we're all helping you out. Maggie's sitting by the phones waiting to take your calls with questions and comments at technology. We'll take anything you'd like. Just give us a ring, 476-2800. Toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, nice and slow. In the 831 area code, 476-2800. And toll-free in California, 1-800-655-5877. I think we'll go ahead and take the next call as soon as I find it in my log. Oh, where are we?
There's been a lot of rumors that Palm might get bought by somebody. I guess they're perfect for a buy. They're a perfect buy.
They're a perfect buy. We should join forces and buy it.
I'd love to hear what Chris has to say about that.
We have to get Chris on again. He's in Florida right now. All right, Ann from Salinas. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question today, Ann?
My question is, I live down in the Salinas Valley.
Okay.
And so I don't have access to all the stuff they have in Salinas.
Mm-hmm.
And until recently, we've only been able to have
a dial-up connection?
Dial-up connection.
Sure.
And I have a dial-up, and I can use my iBook anywhere and get internet connection, except home.
Right.
At home, it just keeps... I have
keeps
Safari,
dropping.
And it keeps saying Safari can't find it.
Yeah.
And one of the other teachers said that maybe I had a fuzzy phone line, and I'm not sure what that is.
Right, so your modem connection keeps on breaking down.
When I asked the phone company, they were going, huh?
Well, so your question is, should you go ahead and upgrade to DSL?
Would I need to do anything to my phone line if I got DSL? Because Redshift has recently come down here with DSL.
And are they saying that your house is available? Like they're saying they support DSL at your house, Redshift?
Redshift would support DSL. It supports DSL here in Kingston.
They should be able to determine whether you can.
Well, right now I have Earthlink. Earthlink has DSL, but they don't have DSL in this area.
Yeah, I think Redshift might be marketing incorrectly. What I would do is tell Markshift, you want DSL. Please, you know, let's order it. Let's do it. And then assume that they will actually come out, find out that your house cannot get DSL.
Okay, well, Earthlink says that they don't have DSL in this area.
Right,
so
but Redshift.
From Earthlink to Redshift.
Yeah.
The teacher who told me I probably have a fuzzy line lives across the street from me, and he has Redshift.
He has Redshift? Does it work on DSL?
DSL.
Okay, then go ahead and get it.
If your neighbor has it, that's the really best way to find out if you can get it or not.
What's going to be great about this small company coming out is they're going to know your area. They're going to know the issues. They're going to test your line. They're going to go, you know what? Your phone line to the house is bad, but your internal phone line's bad, so we'll improve something. They're going to want you as a customer. They're going to try to help you out, and I think you should definitely go for it.
Okay.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Alternatively,
the phone company, and they were going, we don't know.
No, Redshift's going to help you out. I like the smaller ISPs that know what's going on.
Yeah,
definitely.
Alternatively, you can check for cable.
Yeah, cable is also a good solution in that they know the connections really well. All right, let's see. Tom from Santa Cruz, we're going to talk a little bit about what, Tom?
Here, let me turn off this radio. you know, I'm having problems. My neighbor, he has this this LimeWire thing, and he gets free music off the internet. And so I said, oh, great, that's so wonderful. I thought I'd try it. So when I tried to download it, my computer said, oh, no, you know, you're going to be open to all these hackers and this and that. So I went ahead and downloaded it, and then suddenly all three of my different antiviruses. I got Norton antivirus, I got Pest Patrol, and then Windows Defender. They all three just objected, and they all said, no, no, you got people looking at your computer, running on your computer. And I was wondering about the safety issues of viruses. Is LimeWire something that is prone to giving computers these kind of problems?
Well, you know, whenever you download a piece of software from the internet, you do open yourself up to viruses and malware.
Yeah.
That's certainly true.
Isn't LimeWire more of a protocol and there's a lot of clients out there?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Just make sure it's a music file. I've never heard of any viruses being put into a music
file. But the actual application that runs the LimeWire service could have adware.
Yeah, LimeWire has had several vulnerabilities over the years.
Oh, have they?
Right, because when I was down there, when I actually had it on there for a moment, because I just, you know, said, let it go, it said that my computer was now being shared with, like, six different people, you know? And I was like, I didn't understand what that meant. I thought that six different people had access to my computer at that point.
That's more of the peer-to-peer file sharing going on.
And
so, in a sense, yes, they...
just for music downloads, or is that, like, all my documents, all my everything.
It's for whatever directories were specified for sharing with LimeWire, which is usually just the music folders that you're downloading from. So the things that you downloaded in the past are being made available for others. But it depends upon how you've configured your setup.
Now, keep in mind that when you're downloading copyrighted material, it's not legal. Or there's some concerns about its legality. I would say it's a legal process. So you want to be careful with what you do. Also keep in mind that any of these services, the information that you're downloading to your computer can be tracked down to the IP address, and the service provider knows your IP address. And they have to keep logs, I think, for 6 months or a year, something like that. So it's possible to get sued is the most likely chance from the RIAA. It's also possible that you could get convicted of something. But
I think I'll stay away from that. Do you have time to hear one more question of mine?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think you guys were talking about systemic. You had a guy on talking about the planets. He had very interesting thing. But I've been trying to download systemic, but every time I download it, I follow the instructions. It talks about unzipping it. I go through the unzip wizard.
I don't even know what systemic is.
Oh, okay. Maybe that was a different...
technology show? You were unfaithful to us?
I'm sorry. I work in San Jose a lot, too, so I listen to them, too.
We'll tell you what we'll do. We'll all look at Systemic, and if we're interested and like it, we'll talk about it next week. And
it's all about planetary, orbits, and it's just...
Sounds cool already.
All right.
Thank you for the call.
Thank you so much.
I also want to suggest, and maybe I should wait a little bit until Tom gets online, but back on the air, back listening to the radio, that we suggest a few other sites. If you're interested in downloading music, there's a lot of sites that you can download it, and there's different costs involved in it. Emusic.com has some pretty good download features and purchasing. Of course, there's Apple's iTunes iStore. You have to buy a client to access that. And then there's Amy Street, AmieStreet.com. They got an interesting thing where every song starts free, and every person that gets it, it's the song costs another cent. So the first person costs a cent, second person costs 2 cents, until it gets to a dollar, and then it stops at a dollar. So if you get into new music that no one's downloaded yet, you can get really inexpensive music. That's amystreet.com. And emusic.com does not have DRM, which is really nice. So when you do purchase the song, the MP3 file, you have a legal copy and that you paid for it. And now you can play it on any player that you have, maybe burn CDs. So there's a lot more flexibility. Let's go ahead and take a call from Greenfield, I guess. Maury, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello. What's your question today?
I have two, actually. I have a Toshiba notebook, laptop, and I'm having two problems with it. One, I cannot access my district email with it, either at school or at home.
You can't get your district email with what client?
I just log on to my district and then log on to their webmail.
Mm-hmm.
It won't accept my name or password. But if I come home and get on my old desktop, then I can.
Because it's saved your user.
And I'm wondering if it's my preferences, my...
Right. Is it saving? When you go to the online, the form at home, is the thing already filled out for you? And you just have to push next?
No.
So you have to type it in, you're typing the same stuff in.
I'm typing in the same stuff, but it...
It's different.
I'm wondering if it's the cookies or whatever.
It could be cookies not set at the place you're logging into remotely. Lots of times these systems will, you know, log you in and they'll send you a cookie for the session state. And then the next page they'll load, they'll check to see if you have it. And that's the authentication process. And the error message is the same message. It says you can't log in. But in reality, it says it's really what's happening is your cookies aren't being set. That's definitely a possibility.
Okay, so I should check that level.
Yeah, I would definitely make sure. Does your district office have a good tech support person?
Well, he did, but I understand that the job's going to be coming up. Now he's moving on.
Oh, he's moving on. Well, get him before he moves on. Say you're going to really miss him, and can you help him out with this problem?
Okay.
Because they'll probably know because they see a lot of people in the same situation.
Right. Well, it's mostly Macs at school, and I have a PC. Well, about 8 of us have PCs, and we bring our own.
Right. Be careful with what's on them. Somebody was prosecuted for putting their personal machine in front of kids because inappropriate material came up.
Oh, no, I'm have no problem with that.
good. Well, thank you for the call. I definitely talked to those people.
Can I have one more?
Yeah, go ahead.
With this Toshiba again, and I want to get it decided before the year warranty is up on it.
Should you buy it? Extended warranty?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It plays DVDs or CDs. If I play the CDs, the music blasts you out. I can put my external speakers. Everybody in the room can hear it. It's wonderful. If I put a DVD in it, and I don't care if it's a purchased DVD from the store or one that came with our district curriculum.
It's too quiet?
Can't hear it.
Okay. The DVD player that's playing the DVD probably has a software setting. But I'd also suggest down on the right hand in the menu bar and down on the right should be a little icon of a speaker.
Yeah.
Double click that and play with those levels.
Everything.
Nothing.
You might want to check the audio properties of the DVD player.
Okay. I was wondering if I needed to, like, download a new driver or.
No, I would check. I would go into the DVD player while it's up and go to properties or options and look for the audio tab and make sure that those settings are correct.
Thank you so much for the call. Good luck.
And, of course, it'll have its own audio, too, probably. Make sure the audio in the player is, the sound level's high. But it sounds like she's getting audio, so maybe she just needs to turn it up.
Yeah, it's also the thing is that CD players, lots of times, have an audio connected right to the motherboard, and that's a different type of audio in.
It is.
Than looking at the audio directly. And so that has a different amplitude, if you will. And that's why I suggest an advanced tab of the sound settings and make sure all the sliders are the one you want and find out. A little fun, but sounds like she's done that. Playing with computers, I'm reminded that is a very important thing to do because if you're scared with them, if you're scared about computers, they'll win because they're out to get us, of course.
nice.
This is Geek Speak. The Aaron with me, Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland. Over chat, backing us up, making us sound smarter than we actually are, Chris Dunphy and Dee Dee Hubbard. Let's see, there's a few things that I wanted to talk about. We're not going to be able to take any more calls because we're running short on time, but we talked about, I'd mentioned eMusic.com and AmyStreet.com. Both of them have DMR free. This is a really important thing when you're dealing with purchasing music. If you pay money for music and then you can only play it on some players, you're really pretty restricted on what you can do. So I suggest getting non-digital rights management on your songs. All right, GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The Geeks this morning were Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. Answering the phone was Maggie Cleveland. Thank you so much for making GeekSpeak what it is. And to those listening, thank you for listening and staying with us. For those that called in, thanks for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org.